July 2nd, 2008. This is class 36 in the Then and Now series. This will be our second last class. The last class will be next week. Tonight, we're going to look at the 10 stages of a bodhisattva and start on Buddhahood. And then next week, we'll be discussing the rest of Buddhahood, whatever we don't get through today, as well as Buddha activity and any questions you may have from the whole course. So bring them on. Now, the last four chapters in The Dual Ornament of Liberation, dealing with the five paths, the 10 stages, Buddhahood, and Buddha activity, contain a tremendous amount of technical material. The language is highly coded. All of this material, these descriptions, come from the period in India when Buddhism arguably reached its peak, which was probably the late medieval period, where you had the huge monastic colleges, you had literally tens of thousands of monks at a place like Nalanda studying and debating, and you had other very large Buddhist colleges in India, and they made lists galore, cross-referenced this stuff, thought it through, all of these different interpretations. And so we get a series of very, very elaborate descriptions of the progression of the way to enlightenment, all of the different things that happen at each stage, what full awakening is actually like and how it manifests. And these descriptions are very, very far removed from what we understand as the exigencies of day-to-day life. They sound so high and lofty and there's a tremendous amount of idealism invested in them that we wonder, well, what is this? There's virtually no indication of what does this mean in terms of ordinary people. By this point in Buddhism, Buddha had developed, the notion of Buddha had developed into a symbol of something that was far, far beyond ordinary human experience. And there were extraordinary qualities attached to a Buddha, which will be going through some of them. I'm not going to go through them in great detail. They're well footnoted, and the material appears in the glossary, and particularly in Kensho Jeltsin's book. What I want to do as we go through this is try to penetrate some of the language and explore to the extent that we can, what does this actually mean in terms of psychological and spiritual shifts that take place in the course of awakening. So to that end, I prepared this little chart, which I think all of you have, in which I took all of the material of the on the 10 stages of bodhisattva, of bodhisattvas, and plugged it into an Excel spreadsheet. So on the first column to the left, you'll see we have the names of the various stages. Kara.
Can you make this available to people playing at home?
Yes, I suppose. I think we can convert it to a PDF file and throw it up on the website.
Great.
Yeah. And I figured we'd have to do that so I can I'll send it to Franca this evening. Shouldn't be a problem. We can put it up on the Ning site. Actually, I can do that. That's easy to do. Even on the Facebook, I think. Can you attach files from Facebook?
I think so.
Well, certainly on the Ning site we can do that. It's not a problem. So the first column are the names, and the second column is the meaning of the name, or why that is the name for that particular level. And the third column is the kind of training that takes place at that level. The fourth column is a special practice. The fifth column is that's the refinement, which is described in terms of a metaphor, which we'll go through. The next column is what kind of understanding or knowing arises. This is usually translated as realization, but it's the direct knowing. And then and you'll see that in the column after that is what is abandoned. And this is a mistranslation in my term, in my view, of the term pong in Tibetan. I don't know what the Sanskrit is, but you know, it's very things. You know, we abandon faults. This is a misuse of English. I mean, how many of you, when was the last time any of you abandoned a fault? Did you leave it alone in the woods somewhere? It's not what we do with faults. You know, the faults stop in us, or something like that. They dissolve, or something like that. So we have to pay attention to the actual use of English. But this is, to my mind, the best term here, arguably, is stop. And the last two columns, what kind of birth you experience, this is at best highly metaphorical, and it's possibly just straight mythical. And then the last column is about all the wonderful things you can do at each stage, which has been a course of consternation when when you try to integrate the Mahamudra description of experience with the 10 levels of experience, because the Mahamudra description says, well, when you get to this stage of Mahamudra, that's first level bodhisattvahood. And then it says, but we don't experience being able to see 100 Buddhas and enter 100 absorptions, so how do we put these two things together? And it's a big debate about that. And what you have here is the tension that arises quite naturally between descriptions that are highly poetic, highly mythical, and highly symbolic, and descriptions which are actually based on actual experience. And it's not always easy to integrate those two. Mainly because they're using very, very different forms of language. So let's go through these. The first stage of bodhisattvahood arises when at the path of seeing, if you remember that from the five paths from last time. And this refers to seeing the nature of experience, which is, of course, emptiness, and knowing that to be how things are. In a lot of respects, this is where practice actually begins, which may sound completely deflating because, I mean, I have to get that far before I've even got to the beginning. And in my opinion, it's very questionable, or it's a very interesting question to consider. What does this actually refer to in terms of our own experience? These descriptions make it sound very lofty, as do the descriptions of the five paths, where in order to attain this, you have to have 24-hour stable samadhi or stable attention, which, you know, that seemed like pretty far out there. Not too many human beings ever get to that stage. So are we relegated to sitting at the being like the person who just is looking in the window and seeing all of these wonderful things that we can never know, or is there something else going on here where we can actually relate to this? And my own view, which is not probably not a traditional view, is that this is very attainable. That is, you can come to see how things are through our own efforts. And when we do that, everything changes. We can't go back to our ordinary way of living. And there's often a tremendous joy that comes with this, because now that we know that whatever state of mind arises, whether it's peace or disturbance, it is simply a state of mind. It has no ground. It is not a thing in itself. And so we know the freedom in everything that we experience. And that's why it's called the joyful one. Now, I'm going to leave it to you to look through all of the different trainings. If you look in Khenchok Jaltsen's book on page 450 or so, you'll see that, actually I think it starts on page 448. You will see that these are all footnoted, the 10 subjects and the 10 topics of training at the first level, and there's a list of them. And then footnote 3, you'll see that there's another list there, and footnote 5, another list, and footnote 6, another list. And on page 450 and 451, there's just one list after another. And so I have the impression that you had masses of scholars and masters sitting around, and these were gradually, these lists were developed about as descriptions. How much of this is based in actual experience? How much was speculation? I haven't got a clue. All I know is that as we develop, different abilities grow, we need to learn different things. And this gives some idea of the range of things, the richness and the all the different aspects to awakening, that these things would be subjects of study and training. And you'll see that they're also highly idealized. At this level, the primary practice is one of generosity. It's the first of the six perfections. And you see, we just go through the perfections here. And if we look at the metaphor is about making a very beautiful piece of jewelry. And the first step is you get this gold ore. And the first thing you have to do to that gold ore is heat it in order to burn off or melt the parts of it that are impure. The particular understanding that arises is that you know the groundlessness of all experience, and so you know that pure being, which the technical term for pure being here in Sanskrit is Dharma Dhatu. I shouldn't have translated this. No, Dharma Dhatu is not pure being, that's Dharmata. Shouldn't have translated this as pure being. Dharma Dhatu is the totality of experience. Now, actually, they're equivalent. Pure being and the totality of experience are synonyms. But this is coming into an experience of complete knowing. And with that, a whole bunch of emotional reactions, kleshas, just stop. Because you see through them. They no longer have any hold. And then we go to the second level. The second level is called the stainless one. It's because here you become very, very clear about your ethical conduct. And then if you look, there are the eight trainings, which you'll see on page 449. And you see that almost all of them have a sense of morality about them. And the image here, and morality is the perfection which is emphasized at this level. And then the image here is now you clean the gold by adding acid, which dissolves all of the impurities in it. And again, that relates to morality. And there's an increased appreciation of what it means to be in the totality of one's experience. And again, a whole bunch of emotional reactions stop. And it's the same now. Those emotional reactions just decrease steadily through the 10 stages, and there isn't any more description in the text of that. And so we can go through all of these. The radiant one emphasizes patience, polishing. And I don't see much point in going through all of these because the main thing is how do we relate, from my point of view, is how do we relate this to our experience? Well, if you go through all of all of the treatments of the 10 stages, you discover all kinds of little jewels. For instance, at the fifth stage, which is called difficult to train, because you have to let go of attachment to results, well, there's a little jewel right there. This is, I mean, you're pretty conversant with the empty nature of experience. But there's still this hankering after getting somewhere. And actually letting go of that notion of getting somewhere is a very, very deep conditioned propensity in us. It's not so easy to let that go. Also at this stage, it's said that you give up the five methods of wrong livelihood. I can't remember all five, and these apply fairly specifically to monks, but they're kind of interesting. Monks were dependent upon the laity for food, clothing, shelter, etc. So, a monk might give a lay person a nice rosary or mala for saying prayers or something like that, with the hope of getting some bigger donation later. Or that's one of the methods of wrong livelihood. So if you give something to someone with the hope of getting something more back, that's basically a form of manipulation. Another one was... our retreat director explained it to us, is, you know, you're walking along and it's cold and you see a nice warm coat and you say, you know, it's awfully cold out here. So trying to get something by indirect suggestion and so forth. Now, all of us do this all of the time. But these are not actually clean interactions. So at this stage, you're letting go of those subtle manipulative tendencies in interactions with others. Julia.
In this teaching, there'd be a distinction between a manipulation and a straight request for something that you need.
Well, strictly speaking, monks weren't allowed to make that kind of request. It's one of the obligations or responsibilities of the laity to see what the monk needed. And that's why there is proneness to manipulation. But that actually being strict, acting strictly within the Vinaya, you just took what was given to you and you didn't try to get things. It's a really hard practice.
But that wouldn't be relevant to a lay person because there's nobody there who's supposed to be looking out for us.
That's right. Yeah. We take care of ourselves, but at the same time, I think the message for lay people is you don't use manipulation in your interactions, which is extremely common, you know, and quite subtle forms of manipulation, as we all know. So, if we were, I think it might at some point be worthwhile doing a class just on, say, the 10 levels and really studying and pulling out all of these gems. But in the time frame that we have here, that's just not feasible because you really have to get very, very deeply into the material, read it very carefully and uncover it because these gems are buried in all of this very flowery poetic and symbolic language, which is where Buddhism had developed. You know, and don't forget, we're talking now approximately at least 1,000 years, and really 1,000 to 1,500 years after Buddha lived. So it's a very, very long time. Chuck, please.
Do they have to go from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4, or can they jump from 1 to 5 to 3?
Well, the 10 stages are, I think we covered this a little bit last time, the 10 stages mark the degree to which the experience of the totality of experience or the experience of pure being is present in one's experience all the time. When a first level bodhisattva is resting in emptiness, that's equivalent that he or she is supposedly having the same experience as you would have when you're Buddha, when you're fully awakened. But the difference is when you get up from that meditation, how much is that experience or understanding actually present in your interaction in life? And we all know there's quite a difference there. The technical terms in Tibetan are composure and subsequent understanding or subsequent attainment. Composure is when you're sitting in formal meditation, you know, that is when attention is unmixed with activity. You know how things are, that completely groundless things arise like dreams, like illusions. You get up from that, and at the beginning, that's not too present in your life. By the time you reach full Buddhahood, there's no difference between when you're meditating or when you're sitting unmixed with activity and when you're doing things. So what the 10 stages of Bodhisattva describe is the extent to which you're able to mix, to be active and doing things and still have that quality of completely present, awake attention. And in this sense, there's a gradual, it's not so much as climbing stairs, it's actually a gradual growth of an ability. And I think the better metaphor, rather than looking at it as stages, step one, step two, step three, where you, that would be the natural question, can you skip steps, is as a process of something growing. And when something grows, you know, it has to go. It's a process of evolution. There's no possibility of skipping steps. It's just you're just growing gradually in abilities, and these things unfold.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You follow?
Right. Okay, okay. Thank you.
So what I did here was just to summarize this, and I invite you to read it over in the text. There are various language problems, translation problems, of course. And what Gampoba did here was actually to summarize what is in several of the sutras. There's a sutra called the Ten Stages of a Bodhisattva Sutra, which goes into the stuff in great, great detail. So he's not giving the fullest explanations himself, which is why Kensho Jelson had to footnote it extensively to listing all of those qualities at each stage. But I'm not sure that for our purposes... there's one other point that is important. There is a distinction made between the seventh and eighth stages. Stages 1 to 7 are regarded, if you can believe this, as the impure stages. And stages 8, 9, and 10 are regarded as the pure. And there's a shift that takes place. If you look at the metaphors, you will see that everything up to stage 7 is about making this beautiful piece of jewelry. So you heat the gold, you purify it with acid, you polish it, you shape it into some kind of piece of jewelry, you add precious stones, you add, at that point, the most precious of precious stones, which is lapis, and then you add all kinds of other things. And now you've made this thing, and now what determines its value is who wears it. And so there's a shift that takes place there. So up to this point, there's been a growth or an evolution, as I was just talking with Chuck about that, of experience. And the way that this is coordinated with the Mahamudra progression is that at this between the seventh and eighth stages, a different kind of realization arises, and it's called one taste or one flavor. And that is, and that frees you from preference. That is, it doesn't matter what arises, it all has the same taste. It's just experience. And this is something that is stable in one's understanding. And that's why it's called, it's one of the reasons why it's referred to as immovable. One is no longer disturbed by anything. This isn't the immovableness or immobility of rigidity. It's not like you're really just sitting there. It's that there's nothing left in you to react. And so it is an immovability which comes from being completely open and present. It can't be disturbed because there's nothing for anything to push against, which is a very, very different form. And so these are referred to as the higher levels of bodhisattva. And these are the kinds of distinctions that I think are worth digging out and uncovering in your reading, that you can have a very deep experience of emptiness, of the groundlessness of experience, and still exercise preference. And still be run essentially by preference, and to reach a stage in your life where you're actually not preference no longer ceases, no longer operates in you. That's a fairly significant shift. And this is what I mean by reading the language and reading these accounts and seeing what are the things that are actually being referred to. So with that, I think I'm going to move to Buddhahood, unless there are any other questions. So in Kenshop Jotsen's book, this is 281, now, as a religion develops, somebody said, you know, in religions, the more remote the past, the greater the perfection, or the higher level of perfection. So as people recede in history, they come to have higher and higher levels of understanding. And so this goes back to Buddha. I mean, here we're describing Buddha. And this is 1,000 to 1,500 years later. And Buddha is made is far removed from being a simple, an ordinary human being, the embodiment of the three kayas of Buddhahood, Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya. We'll discuss these to some extent. All of these wonderful qualities, the 32 major and 80 minor marks of the body begin to appear, and so forth. This is a description of what it means to be a perfect human being. This is something that becomes a source of wonder and inspiration and aspiration for people. Giving concrete form to and concrete description to the object of our spiritual aspiration. After I came back from India the first time, this would be in the early 70s, a teacher that I knew of in India and hadn't actually met, by the name of Lama Karma Tinley, I knew had come to Canada and lived outside Toronto. So I called him up and asked if I go and see him. And my younger brother and my wife and I went to see him. We ended up camping in a field somewhere in the middle of southern Ontario near the house where he was staying. And went to see him. And one of the things, Lama Karma Tinley is quite a character, and he's still in Toronto. And you can never tell what he's going to do or what he's going to say. So we came into his room and we chatted for a while. And then he noticed that my younger brother was looking very intently at a tanka, which Lama Karma Tinley was in the process of painting, and it was only half finished. And it was a depiction of Buddha. And he looked at my younger brother and said, "Are you interested in that?" His English was very minimal. I did most of the translating this stage. And Mangrava said, "I've never seen anything like that." And it was an iconic graphic depiction of Buddha with a gold body and the long ear lobes and the top knot, you know, what we see in Buddha images and depictions. And Mangrava said, "Yeah, I've never seen anything like that." Lama Karma said, "You want to know what it means?" And my younger brother said, "Yes." He said, "Come back tomorrow." So I came back. And for the next 4 hours, Lama Karma Tinley went through all of the 32 major and 80 minor marks of physical perfection which embody the comprise the Nirmalankaya of the Buddha, you know, which is the spiral of hair at this point, and the growth at the top of his head, and the long earlobes, and the shape of the lips, and the length of his arms, and the light web between the fingers, all of these things. You can read them. There's a list of them in the back here. Explaining what they all were, and the these are on page 454. You see the 32 and major and 80 minor marks there. And what the karma, what particular karma they developed from, and what their significance was, and just hours and hours of this stuff. So this is, and I'm just relating this because you have this description here of what it means to be a perfect human being, which is what Buddha was regarded. This is the perfection of our human potential. This is not where Buddhism started at all, 1500 years previous to this, where Buddha would just say of himself, you know, what makes you different from other people? He said, I'm awake. And that was it. But all of this these myths and these symbols grew up around Buddha and became ways of people expressing their appreciation. So if we start into this chapter, we see that the nature of complete perfect Buddha is perfect purification and perfect primordial wisdom. The perfect purification means that here it's the two obscurations, and I prefer to translate obscurations now as distortions. That is, arguably there are three, in some versions there are three, we'll hit that one later. But here the two, and these are translated variously as the two veils, the two obscurations. I'm experimenting translating them as the two distortions. You may even see things like shadowings or what have you, but obscurations is the most common translation. Now, what are they? The first one is the way that emotional reactions distort how we experience things. Anybody familiar with this? Mm-hmm. Familiar with this? Yeah. When we're angry, we see things one way. We don't see them clearly. When we are filled with desire, we see things another way. Again, we don't see them clearly because the emotional reaction itself projects a world, colors all our experience, causes us to misinterpret what is there. We don't see it clearly. So that's why it's an obscuration or distortion. The second and deeper distortion is experiencing things through the filter of conceptual knowing, not knowing things directly. And this is a deeper obscuration or distortion because it's actually the basis of emotional reaction. And I referred earlier to the impure and pure stages of the 10 stages of bodhisattvahood. The lower seven are regarded as the impure stages because all through this, there is still some active distortion operating from the power of emotional reactions, even though you have all of this very deep experience of emptiness. And that's finally finished at the seventh level, at the end of the seventh level. So the eighth, the only active obscuration is the obscuration of conceptual knowing. And again, if you think of this and step out of these high-level descriptions, what's really being said here is that even when you are no longer subject to emotional reaction, the tendency to see things and understand things conceptually is still very deep-seated, and it requires another level of work to really know things directly without the mediation of concept. It's possible, but it's very, very difficult. And then there's the discussion of primordial wisdom. Now, the translation I usually use for primordial wisdom, this term, is pristine awareness. And Gampopa notes that there's a whole bunch of different opinions about this. And there's been an awful lot of discussion over the course of Buddhist history as to the exact nature of pristine awareness. A lot of the problems and a lot of the discussion is trying to determine its ontological status. How is it? Does it exist, etc.? One of the very important things to remember about Buddhism, and I think I've mentioned this before, is that determining the ontological status of anything is an impossible task. We can only know things experientially. So in this regard, Buddhism ultimately is an epistemological approach to experience, not an ontological. But it didn't stop people from trying to ascertain the ontology of things, and that's what gives rise to all kinds of discussion and argument and controversy, etc. My view now is that, and I suppose this is a somewhat radical view, when I was doing the Heart Sutra class the other night, somebody asked me, is this the experience the same as that one? And it's actually impossible for us to say whether any two experiences are the same. You can have an experience of emptiness. You can have experience of strawberry pie. You can have an experience of smelling a flower, the fragrance of a flower. I can have an experience of fragrance, smelling the fragrance of flower, strawberry pie, or emptiness. But there's no way to know whether we're having this, we had the same experience. There is absolutely no way to know. And so, from my point of view, this is very, very important when we look at our practice, because how many of you have approached practice trying to have the right experience? Right. And so you come and you ask somebody, well, I experienced X, Y, and Z. And all, I mean, if you were to come to me and ask me that, how can I know? Did you put up your hand, Kara? You're here. How can I know whether you've had the right experience?
How can you know whether I've had the right experience?
Yeah. You're trying to figure out whether you've had the right experience. You come and you said, I've had this and this and this. Is this correct? I mean, and you have this all the time where students go to teachers to have their experience tested. You've heard about this.
Mm-hmm.
So how's the teacher going to do that?
Well, I guess on some level you would determine just in your own listening and observation if they're telling the truth.
Well, there's no way I can know whether you're telling the truth.
Well, I could come to you and say, you know, I had a vision of X, Y, and Z, and it was amazing, and I think I've woken up.
Yes, there's many stories about this. How am I going to tell whether you told the truth or not?
Because, I don't know, because you're you.
You want to help her out, Art? That microphone's just sitting itching to be used in front of you.
Well, can I just toss something in here real quick?
Sure.
Sorry. I'll let Art have a second to think. Because I would think of it like you are to Buddhist teaching what I would say I am to like a batter making. And so I can look at the end result of something and I can ask questions and say, well, did you put the eggs in at this point? Did you do this to the butter? Like, you know, did you turn the oven temperature down? Blah, 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 blah. And sometimes I can pretty much determine, regardless of their answer, what they did.
And how do you do that? This is a very good example you're bringing up, Carol. So how do you determine that?
By looking at the end result, and also by their reaction when I ask them the question.
Okay. So what are you basing your appraisal on?
Usually on sort of mildly observing, like not watching like a hawk when I'm in a kitchen with somebody, but, you know, I will observe how their technique is applied.
Right.
And then if the end result is wacky, then I can say, well, I can ask questions, and then I can also say, well, I saw this. You tell me if I'm wrong. Yeah.
So you're basing your appraisal on observable things such as behavior.
Right.
Okay. And that's exactly what I'm going to base my appraisal on.
Right.
Is because I can't know your experience.
Right.
But I can observe how you behave, how you report it, what the quality of your tone of voice, presence in your body, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And so there's and from that, go, okay, and the feeling that I have when you're reporting it. So again, this comes down to an experiential thing, but I don't know whether you've had the same experience. What I can tell is how that experience is manifesting in what you're presenting to me.
This may be making it more convoluted, but is it fair to say then that you are basing her experience on your experience, not your own personal experience in terms of what goes on in your practice, but your own personal experience of observing her?
Well, I think Kara's analogy of you know, looking at somebody's batter preparation is a very good one, because when you're trained in batter preparation, you can look at the batter and sometimes figure, no, they added the butter too soon or it wasn't at the right temperature. You can just tell that by looking at the batter. And in the same way, that when you're familiar, very deeply familiar with all the ways that attention grows, you can see the manifestations of attention in a person, in the way a person carries themselves, in the way they express themselves, and not only can see, but you can also feel it. And I know you have some sense of that. And yes, it is based to a good degree on my own experience and what I've learned through my own training, which is why when you're trained in very, very different systems, sometimes people don't communicate very well, because I'm thinking of the great debate between Kala Rinpoche and Sung Sinim, which took place in Boston, and Sung Sinim whipped out an orange and said, "What is this?" which is a typical Zen way of communicating. And Rinpoche looked at this and said something to his translator, and the translator said something like that. This went back and forth for a time. And finally the translator just said, Rinpoche is very confused. Don't they have oranges where he comes from? And so the whole way of communicating was different. At the same time, when you have people from different contemplative traditions talking, there can also be a very deep form of communication that takes place if they aren't stuck with on various forms, because they feel the presence of the other person. So yes, I'm basing it on my own experience, and to the extent, which is why it's very important that one's teacher have some actual experience, because they may or may not, if they don't have a certain level of experience, then they may not be able to connect with what you're talking about. And they may say, well, that doesn't make much sense, and yet you know in yourself that something has happened and it's important, even though you're trying to understand it a bit better. And teacher-student relationships can break down because of that. A friend of mine studied in the Gelugpa tradition, which holds the view that logic is a necessary prerequisite for any deep spiritual experience. And he would go with his meditation experience, and his teachers would say to him flatly, you haven't finished your logic courses, you can't experience that. And he would go, but I did experience that. And I haven't finished my logic course, this doesn't make any sense. So you get into all of these kinds of problems. But my point here that I'm going into this is that you can have the idea when we read this that there is one right experience to have. And what I've moved to is, you can't really say what that experience is, but we can know when a person, we can know the degree of a person's actual spiritual attainment, because we'll see how it manifests in action. Then we'll get into this when we discuss Nirmanakaya, because that's about the manifestation of awakening. And the principle that I've come to is, how present is compassion in what they are? I know some teachers who supposedly have very, very high levels of experience, and they don't treat the people around them with anything that I can see that even remotely looks like compassion. So I wonder, like, what's really going on there? But I want to move away from the idea that there's something that you have to conform to as you rest more and more deeply in your own experience, shifts are going to take place. And that is, it's resting deeply in your own experience that is where spiritual practice comes, spiritual understanding comes from, not from generating the right experience according to the books. Okay? So you get into the possession of primordial wisdom. Well, it's very strange to think of possessing primordial wisdom. It's not a thing that we can actually hold. It's much more is, to what extent is that pristine awareness active in how we experience things? And so I'm trying to shift the basis for this. Bottom of 282, we have the primordial wisdom of actually actualizing reality as it is. Just take a look and see what Gunter does with that wonderful phrase. is talking about Jitava Chimpieshe and Jinepa Chimpieshe. Pristine awareness has two aspects, which can be described basically knowing how things are and knowing how things appear. Now, to put this in very simple, plain language, how things are, they're empty. How do they appear? Like a dream, like a mirage. Now, both aspects are important because it is through knowing how things are that we become free of taking things as real. We know that everything is groundless or empty or open, however you want to put it. And when I say things, I really mean experience. That all experience is groundless. There is absolutely no reference. That, which is really, really difficult to take in. And it's quite terrifying in some ways to live by. There is no reference. Everything is completely open. And yet experience arises. And a good analogy for this is reflection in a mirror. When we look at a mirror such as this, what do you see when you look at the mirror? In particular, do you see the mirror? Art?
No.
No. Okay. When we look at the mirror, we don't see the mirror. We see no thing in that sense. Okay, that's like the pristine awareness of actualizing reality as it is, or what I prefer to say is seeing things as they are. When we look at our experience, we don't see any thing. And what's very important, that not seeing anything is seeing mind. Put this a different way. When you look at space, what do you see? Space, not outer space. When you look at space, what do you see?
Nothing.
Nothing. Okay. And if you look at space long enough, you find that you have to let go of anything because you are not seeing anything. Then any sense of being something which is looking at eventually disintegrates, which is why sky gazing and looking at space is a very deep practice in Buddhism. And where you end up is awareness is looking at itself, or awareness is aware of itself, and in being aware of itself is aware of no thing. That's like looking at the mirror. But when you look at the mirror, even though we don't see the mirror, we see reflections. Now, are those reflections really there? Are those reflections things that exist? No, except maybe if you're a cat or a bird, you regard them that way. But as humans, we don't see them as things that exist, but we see them, and that's and know them to be reflections. That's seeing things as they appear. So here, we can look at the space of this room. And when we look at the space, there is nothing there to be seen. That's the pristine awareness of seeing things as they are. At the same time, what do you actually see when you look at the space of this room? It was a really hard question. Randy?
Looking at the space? Nothing.
What happens when you look at the space? What do you see?
Well, you see the things that are in the space.
Exactly. You see walls and pictures and carpets and people and so forth. Now, I want to move away from those things. All of this experience arises, the shapes and colors and sounds, etc., right? Ordinarily, we know those conceptually, which goes back to that second obscuration or distortion, and we posit there are things out there. But if we just look at this, and there's all of that experience, and we don't construct anything out of it, then we're just in a world of experience, and we have these two aspects to it. Experience is arising, that's knowing things as they appear, and there is no thing there at the same time. You getting the picture? Okay. That's how things are. And that's what's being referred to as, in this section, about primordial wisdom. Now, knowing things as they are and knowing things as they appear is possible when we can know things without the when we can rest in knowing without the projection of thought or emotion, which is a different way of describing those two distortions. The distortion of conceptual knowing is the projection of thought, and the distortion of emotional reactions is the projection of emotion. So we can say that what Buddhahood is to know things without projection of thought or emotion. Now just take that in for a moment. What would that actually be like? And the first thing that often arises is we can't imagine this. Because we're so conditioned to thought and emotion. But if we stay with it a little bit longer than that, we can see that there's going to be a clarity and a precision and an immediacy in that kind of knowing, which are almost unimaginable. And there's going to be no possibility of editing. There's going to be no operation of preference or prejudice. There's actually not going to be any sense of separation between subject and object. There will just be experience itself, experience and awareness arising together. Do you follow? And this is basically what Gampopa is trying to describe here. Now, on page 284, we get into one of the typical kind of thing that happens in with people who study things and try to understand them through studying rather than knowing them through experience. And the question is, so if you have this primordial wisdom, how is it possible to know what is conventionally true? Because if you knew what was conventionally true, that would contradict this primordial wisdom or this pristine awareness. You follow? Now, you can't possibly know things conventionally because you're full or you have this pristine awareness. There must be a special way of knowing. Now, the reason that this comes up is because there's a subtle assigning of an ontological status to pristine awareness, which sets it apart from ordinary experience. But going back to our analogy of the mirror, when you look in the mirror, can you see the reflections? Do you take the reflections to be real things? There's no problem with that. Okay, so that's basically the essence of Gampopa's refutation of this position. It's that in pristine awareness, experience arises and you know its nature, so there's no possibility of falling into confusion again. And as he goes on and discusses this with respect to the Kadampa tradition, and it's very interesting coming down to Milarepa's position. He said, this unfabricated awareness is beyond words and conceptual thoughts, such as existence or non-existence, eternalism, nihilism, and so forth. It will not be contradicted, whatever name is used to express it. Those who would be expected to be scholars, even if they asked Buddha himself, don't think he would say one way or the other. Gunther translates this somewhat differently. It's on page 261 in Gunther. Milarepa used to say that transcending awareness is not discursive, it is beyond any predication such as existence and non-existence, eternalism, nihilism, beyond the realm of the intellect. Whatever name it is called does not alter its nature. This is particularly true of the word transcending awareness. The term was coined by a numbskull, so that even if a Buddha were to be asked to explain it, he could not do so. When it is stated that Dharmakaya is beyond the intellect, unborn and ineffable, or such that one can only say, do not ask me, look into your own mind. Now, and what is interesting is that Milarepa's position is to say, these are simply words. These are terms. They don't refer to anything. And if you were to ask Buddha or anybody else, what is transcending awareness? They wouldn't be able to answer because you're not referring to anything. And you can see how the ontology or trying to say things are has crept in here. How do you come to know this? You look at your own mind. Now, as we've done before, mind, experience, these are really synonymous. So you look at experience. And experience always involves experiencing. So you look at this experience, at the experiencing thing. What happens when you look at experience? Well, we've done this many times. You know, we have a piece of paper here, white piece of paper. Pardon? Pardon?
Are you going
to
tear it?
No, I'm not going to tear it, this one. This is the worst. That's the easy one. This is the harder one. Okay? So everybody has this experience of seeing the white paper, right? Where is the experience? You remember this one? Okay. Where is the experience of seeing the white paper? Where does that experience take place? It does? Then how can I, moving it outside, affect what goes on in there?
The experience changes.
But where is the experience? Is it in your head? If it's in your head, then something, how does what I do outside affect that? How does it experience what is in your head?
How does the paper experience what is in my head?
How does anything I do affect what you are experiencing if the experience actually takes place in your head? See, when I move this piece of paper, I'm not doing anything to your head. Randy, this is really important.
Although the experience takes place in the head, there is input, there is sensory perception.
Does the experience take place in your head?
I can recreate in my head the experience of you moving the paper, whether or not you move it.
Ah, but that's not the experience anymore. Now you've recalled a memory.
Well, I can create the experience, imaginal.
Yeah, but you're not. But that's just something you're conjuring up, and that's a different experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we can ask the same about that one. Where does that experience take place?
Again, I think it takes place in the dynamic, in the interaction.
I'm asking, where does it take place physically? Pardon? Because we have the notion that there, the experience or mind, this is coming from contemporary neuroscience, that these are the product of physical phenomena. Where does the experience take place physically? Actually, we can't pin it down.
To me, the question makes no sense at all. To Why say not? An experience takes place physically is an oxymoron. An experience is not a physical thing.
What is it then? If it's not a physical thing, how is it generated by physical processes?
It's a group of perceptions.
And how are those perceptions generated by physical processes? If they're not physical?
Well, I mean, if you want to get into things like light waves and sound waves.
Those are all physical. How do they generate experience?
Well, they're impinging on our sensory neurons, and our neurons are responding with.
Yes, and how does the electrochemical reactions that take place generate an experience?
Oh, we're clueless.
Okay. And so, but experience arises, right? Can you say where that experience is?
Not in a physical location, no. Okay.
This is very important. Because, and you're quite right, we can't say where that experience is. Now, in that experience, what is the relationship between what experience is that, and what is experienced?
That's one of the great
No, but in it, when you have that experience, seeing the white paper, what is the relationship between what experience is that and what is experienced?
Are you asking about an observer of the experience?
I'm actually talking about the experiencer and the experienced. Not the observer of the experience. That's a whole other level of complication.
You're talking about the paper and the person who sees the paper.
Well, we're not sure whether it's a person, but there's an experiencing or an experiencer, if you wish, And there's the...
You're asking where the homunculus is.
I'm not sure what homunculus means.
The little man in your head.
Yeah.
That neuroscience hasn't answered that one yet.
No. But in the actual experience, you can't separate the experiencing from the being experienced. But that's exactly what we do ordinarily. Okay? So, what I'm trying to point to here is that in that experiencing, there is no subject, there is no object, and there is no reference as to being outside or inside. There's just experience. We can't put any name to this. We can't describe it. And when we experience things that way, then we're completely freed from subject-object differentiation. We know we are not separate from what we experience. But if you're asked to name, what is this? Or what is this wisdom, or what is this knowing? You can't point to anything. And this is exactly what Milarepa is saying here. That experience is ineffable, unnameable, indescribable. And if you want to know it, you don't get at it by trying to understand it or trying to reason it out. You get at it by looking very just straight at experience itself. And you end up doing here is you end up looking at space in the way that I was referring to earlier. And in that looking at space, bit by bit, awareness just becomes aware of itself. And you're resting with no separation. And the main thing that I'm trying to get across here is that any attempt to describe or understand this intellectually immediately ties us up in knots. And yet this is what's been going on for thousands of years, even in Buddhism, with these very elaborate, very detailed explanations, which Gampopa is summarizing here. We're going to go further into this next week because we've got to go through the three kayas now. The 9:30 now? Yeah, okay. I'm going to give you a meditation exercise. Take a small mirror and put it in front of you. When you look at the mirror, you see reflections. You don't see the mirror. You know the mirror is there because of the reflections. And I want you to spend some time just resting, looking right at the mirror, every time the reflections catch your attention, let that go and return to just looking at the mirror. And as you do this over and over again, your relationship with the reflections is going to shift. You're going to start looking at the mirror without being caught by the reflections, which doesn't mean to say you won't see the reflections, but you won't be grabbing at them, if you understand what I mean. Mm-hmm. Okay. When you're able to do that, even a little bit. Then look at the world around you in exactly the same way. So just as you've been able to look at the mirror without being grabbed by the reflections, now look at your world without being grabbed by what arises as experience. And this can include what appears to be objects outside as well as thoughts. And when you do that, you're going to be looking at mind in exactly the same way that when you're looking at the mirror, you're looking at the mirror. Do you follow? I just want you to practice that. Tell me what you experience. So here we are sitting in this room. We have all of these shapes and colors and things like that. And ordinarily we see these as objects out there. But actually it's just experience arising. And when we're looking at this, we're actually looking at our mind. And you can do the same thing with thoughts. You can just allow yourself to let thoughts float up. And when you see thoughts, you're actually seeing mind. Now, necessarily, these are going to be thoughts coming up one by one. If you get into thinking, then you've lost that kind of clarity of attention. And you've moved into discursiveness, which is very different. But you just look at thoughts. You can even do it with sound or sight. You're just looking. This is going to give you some taste of this primordial wisdom or pristine awareness in which this whole chapter is based on. Part two of this is when you experience things that way, what manifests in your behavior? Or put a less simple English, how are you inclined to behave? Conduct yourself. Yeah, when you experience that shift, okay. How does that? Let's just say, how does that affect your behavior? And this is the subject matter of the three kayas, which is what we'll go into next week. So you can read. Page in Kensho Jiaozen, page 2. Well, actually, read the rest of the book from 287 up to 300. That goes into Buddha activity, which we'll do a slightly different take of that. And that will be the subject matter of our class, our next and last class next week. Julia, questions? Is this clear? I'm trying to take it out of this very high-flown vocabulary and put it into something which I hope is a little bit closer to experience. Okay, Kara?
And I would just... make a plug for the YouTube video that you posted on the Ning site when you were talking about Buddhism in the modern world.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fantastic lecture where he talks about the comportability of Buddhism, and a lot of what you talked about tonight is relevant to that lecture, especially if anyone's feeling lost.
Okay, good. Yeah, the portability of sanctity. If you go to the Ning site, our the social network site, you know the one, unmind.ning.com, you'll see that there's a discussion called Buddhism and Modern, and Modern or something like that. Modernity.
Buddhism in the Modern Age.
Buddhism in the Modern Age. And you'll see that I've put a link to a one-hour lecture, which is up on YouTube, by a scholar at Berkeley who was asked to talk about Buddhism in the Modern Age. And he introduces the notion that Buddhism, unlike many religions, had developed a portable sanctity. That is, what was worshipped or regarded as sacred in Buddhism wasn't tied to a geographic location. It could be moved around and was moved around because there was relics. So it allowed Buddhism to spread far beyond India in a way that Hinduism has never been able to.
The current culture.
To whatever culture it was in. Yeah. Okay. Chuck, ready?
You have just heard a talk by Ken McLeod, author of Wake Up to Your Life and director of Unfettered Mind, a California nonprofit corporation. This podcast and many others can be found on both iTunes and on the Unfettered Mind website at www.unfetteredmind.org. This podcast is free and has been made available through generous donations from our listeners. We would appreciate any assistance you can offer. Your tax-deductible donations may be made through the Unfettered Mind website, unfetteredmind.org, where you will find translations, articles, information about Buddhism, and other programs given by Ken McLeod. All rights in this podcast, given by Ken McLeod, are owned by Unfettered Mind. Unfettered Mind hereby grants you, the listener, the non-exclusive license to listen to and distribute this podcast freely, but only without charge and only if each copy contains all the original contents and these proprietary notices. You may not charge any fee of any kind for making a copy of this podcast available in any form. You may not extract portions of this podcast except for commentary purposes and only if you give proper attribution and this proprietary notice. You may not include this podcast, or any portion thereof, with any other podcasts, talks, information, or data for which any amount is charged. Title, ownership rights, and intellectual property rights in and to this podcast shall remain in Unfettered Mind. This podcast and all elements within it are protected by the copyright laws of the United States and international copyright treaties.